538,000 of whom are severely malnourished. Further troubling is that 1.3 million pregnant and lactating women are also suffering from acute malnutrition. More and more children are going to bed hungry in Yemen, UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell said in a statement, adding, "This puts them at increased risk of physical and cognitive impairment and even death." She said, "The plight of children in Yemen can no longer be overlooked. Lives are at stake." In a statement earlier this month, WFP Executive Director David Beasley warned that the Saudi-led U.S.-backed invasion of Yemen will impact global supply chains and the cost of food. Beasley expressed concern that malnourished Yemeni children have been forgotten by the world. Reacting recently to the IPC report, Beasley said, "These harrowing figures confirm that we are on a countdown of catastrophe in Yemen and we are almost out of time to avoid it." He said, "Unless we receive substantial new funding immediately, mass starvation and famine will follow. But if we act now, there is still a chance to avert imminent disaster and save millions."
Disasters that threaten the population of the Gaza Strip.
How's your work? What have you accomplished? Not much. We stopped the construction of the house because of the construction materials crisis in the Gaza Strip. There are no construction materials available, no cement, no steel, and no whitewash. Most construction materials stopped entering the strip due to the Egyptian army's military operations in the Sinai. In addition, they have already destroyed most of the tunnels between Egypt and Gaza, through which all materials used to enter. Now they have disappeared from the local market. On the other hand, Israel has been blocking all crossings to the Gaza Strip for 7 years.
When we decided to expose the problem of unemployment in the Gaza Strip, we were confused about a starting point, but we met with an informative colleague, Mr. Atif Isa, who paved the way for us. He told us about his suffering over 7 years in building his dream house, which is still under construction at the moment. According to his plan, it was supposed to be done 5 years ago.
According to my house plan, the house is supposed to be ready now, and I would have moved into it. But as you can see, it seems to be ready from the outside, but work still needs to be done. These days, I am supposed to have at least 5 or 6 teams working at the same time. These teams provide job opportunities to about 30 or 40 workers. That means there are 30 to 40 families that used to have income, but not anymore because I have stopped the building of my house. I'm the head of a family of 6 people. All I want is a job opportunity, and everything will go fine with me. I wish other workers could work too, like the old days of working in a team. There were supposed to be more than 20 workers working on this scaffolding. However, there are only 2 or 3 people because of the shortage in construction materials. Their being here is inconsistent. As you can see, no improvements seem to occur.
These two workers are the only ones among over 30 who continued working here to make a living. Ibrahim, Raed's colleague and cousin, is the only one who remained to work with him, doing some modest jobs, despite knowing very well that he's not the right person in the right place.
I have learned the Holy Quran by heart and studied at private schools. Then I pursued my study in Malaysia at East Asia University. My major was the Prophet's Hadiths. After that, I came back to Gaza. As you can see, I work in construction. We have no chance to work in related fields. The crossings are blocked, and there aren't any projects or development. There is nothing. There are approximately 35,000 unemployed graduates. Because of the blockade, this number has risen in light of the rapid increase in the number of graduates from the Palestinian and Arab universities. This means that there is a large number of graduates per year. More than 10,000 graduates joined the previous number of the unemployed because of the lack of opportunities.
Hamza Hassan from the beach refugee camp has joined the army of the unemployed after 4 years of study in the English literature department at the Faculty of Arts. 2 years after graduation, he lives a conflict between dreaming of his certificate and looking for any job, even if it's not related to his field of study.
I graduated from university after 4 years of studying English literature. I and most of the other young people were surprised with the fact that there are no work opportunities. Even if one does not want to work in one's field of study, it is hopeless. Youth also suffer from boredom. Young people spend some time out, just like myself. We spend most of our time in having food, sleeping, and hanging out.
The Gaza Strip is surrounded by 7 crossings. The Rafah crossing is the only one connecting the Gaza Strip with an Arab country, Egypt. But the other 6 crossings are fully controlled by the Israeli occupation. And most of them are completely blocked most of the time. The only commercial crossing left partially open is the Kerem Shalom crossing. It is controlled by the Israeli soldiers' mood.
The needs of the Gaza Strip exceed 800 trucks a day. Meanwhile, the Israeli occupation prevents more than 480 to 500 trucks from entering Gaza. These goods are very important for the development of the Palestinian economy and include all raw materials, machinery, and equipment required for the development of the economy or solving the problems of production lines. I am Majid Abdul Hafiz Abu Salim. I own a sewing factory that produces bags. This bag factory has stopped working for a long time because of the siege and the occupation. This is a leather sewing machine that we use in producing leather bags. All these machines as well. As you see, they are all off. There were 12 to 15 workers. However, after the blockade, the factory has stopped. All the workers have lost their jobs and spend their time at home or in hanging out. I used to work as a tailor. I haven't worked for almost 9 years now because of the siege, the blockade, and the Israeli restrictions. I have 6 daughters, 3 sons, and there's my wife and I. I cannot fulfill their needs. We're currently living by help and aid. Our life is very difficult, and the unemployment rate has become great. When school started, I didn't buy new bags, clothes, or anything for my kids, because I was not ready to buy them their school needs and let them suffer hunger later. Thank God I'm not renting my house. May Allah help those who rent. I am not renting, though I suffer very much.
الله يساعد المتأجرين دور يعني أنا داري مش متأجرها ووضعي كئيب جدا جدا.
أنا سجين مبعد ساكن بيت إيجار.
I am a deported prisoner and I am renting a house. Currently, my family lives by relief supplies and aid. There isn't a job opportunity and the situation is really difficult. As you see, I have 6 kids. Come in, please. This is one of my 6 kids. Please come in. This is Muhammad. He is sick. What does he suffer from? He has convulsions, epilepsy, mental retardation, and speech difficulties. If he walks along the street, he wouldn't know where he is going. Every time he goes out by himself, I go bring him from a different place.
My sister-in-law has got rid of this closet, and I thought of removing my kids' clothes into it instead of being on the floor. All the kids' clothes are damaged. If my husband had a job with a monthly income of $200, not $400, it would be enough to pay for the owner of the house the first month, and the next month, we could buy a closet like most of the people. We could buy a bed for ourselves. We had a bed and a closet when we got married, but we sold them to afford the housing rent, because the house owners would kick us out. They're not tolerant, and they would ask for their money. The house does not have appropriate doors or windows, but we had no choice.
I tried to get a job. I worked as a taxi driver, but it wasn't helping because of the fuel crisis. And if you want to do something else, it must be at the expense of your health. I used to work in construction, but construction has stopped in the strip. The crossings are all blocked, and the situation is very bad. The construction materials are very expensive and rare. I am sick and can't do tiring work. In winter, water reaches up to this level. Even when I tried to make a hole in the wall to let the water out, some of the street water started flooding, and its level was higher than the kids' knees. We used to fill 6 or 7 buckets with water to get rid of it. People like winter, but I don't. I don't like it because it is tiring. This is our kitchen. The walls are cracked because of the rocket shelling during the war.
The Shaban's house is already cracked by poverty and also by the missiles of the 2 wars on Gaza, the 2008-2009 war and the late 2012 war. The Israeli rockets accurately hit targets other than the Shaban's house. They destroyed nearly 1,000 of a total of 4,000 industrial facilities. Many of the rest have completely stopped working due to the blocking imposed on the Gaza Strip since
mid-2007.
This factory used to work in concrete in the Gaza Strip. It provided job opportunities to about 70 workers. During the pre-war period, we had 17 mixing vehicles and 7 concrete pumps. 10 of these vehicles were destroyed, and only 7 remained. In spite of this, I want to bring this factory to life again to make a living. I want to contribute to the reconstruction of Gaza, but now there are small quantities of goods entering Gaza. More than 3,900 factories have stopped either completely or partly as a result of the prevention of raw materials and production requirements from coming in. Moreover, the Israeli occupation bombed many industrial facilities during the last 2 wars on the Strip. Most of the destroyed institutions started having problems with any production process. This made more than 45,000 workers, only in the field of production and industry, lose their jobs, which has led to an increase in unemployment.
With the siege tightening and factories systematically destroyed by the Israeli occupation, Gazans are tempted to break the siege through digging underground tunnels along the border with Egypt to bring in their daily needs of food and medications, as well as raw materials that may contribute to operating some industrial facilities in one way or another.
Many industrial institutions and laborers were working when some of the materials were allowed in through the tunnels. This softened the effects of the siege on the strip. These tunnels, or the ground crossings as we call them, provided job opportunities to 35,000 workers in the construction sector and other industrial sectors through the entry of raw materials. My basic profession is sewing. As you know, sewing is not common now. We used to have orders from the north of Palestine. The crossings are blocked now, and there are no exchanges with Israel. In general, the sewing profession has stopped now, and I came to Rafah. In Rafah, there were opportunities and tunnels. Our area of concentration was construction materials, and especially gravel. Lately, transporting gravel has become difficult, so we started transporting goods. Merchants started providing us with goods through the tunnels. We rebuilt the factory. It used to give jobs to 70 employees. Now we are running one factory with one operational capacity. There used to be 70 people, but now there are only 30.
Tunnels became a lifeline for the residents of the Gaza Strip. The economy began to recover, and unemployment rates were significantly reduced, either because of work in the tunnels or the supply of goods, especially with thousands of tons of cement, steel, and gravel arriving daily. All of that led to dozens of large enterprises, including the reconstruction of Gaza after the Israeli destruction of thousands of houses and public facilities. But all of these improvements have stopped with the demolition of the tunnels. Gaza became besieged again, causing the unemployment rates to increase.
There is destruction in tunnels. Every day, a cement or steel tunnel is destroyed. The tunnel line requires at least 20 workers. It may be more, but there are not less than 20. The Egyptians said they have destroyed 350 tunnels. This is what has been destroyed. We don't know whether they have destroyed the rest or not. They have demolished 300 or 360 tunnels, each requiring 20 workers. This means that a total of about 6,000 workers are now unemployed. Relying on tunnels was not on the agenda of the Palestinians. This means bringing in food, clothes, and medication through the tunnels. But the phenomenon was forced on the Gazans, leaving them with no choice. Thus began the circle of providing jobs to the deprived in construction and production factories because of the Israeli restrictions. When Egyptian security takes an action in this regard, along with not allowing these materials to officially enter the strip, the problem of unemployment will become worse. I was doing well, and now I've got 30 workers. However, if tunnels remain blocked, I will reduce the number to half because there are no goods coming in. I recently divided the workers into two groups. Each works for 15 days. If the situation remains the same, I may lay off 15 workers, and I will cause the destruction of 15 families. I was working for a short period of time. Now I have stopped because there is no cement. I have 13 people in my house. Four of my sons are unemployed. They are all illiterate. No one else is employed. I have to take care of my daughters, my wife, and my daughters-in-law. The situation used to be different. There were job opportunities, and life went on. We used to work and make a living for the family. Life was better. Nowadays, the situation is different because there are no goods or cement, the crossings are blocked, and there's a siege imposed. I don't use the work equipment I have, and I have to afford the living expenses of 13 people.
Everybody is unemployed. There is no chance for construction workers, laborers, and contractors. They're all unemployed. Where will they find jobs? Even employees are complaining about the hard situation. If you intend to borrow some money from an employee, he will tell that his salary is hardly enough for him and his children. For those who receive salaries at the end of the month, they keep telling that it's not enough. An employee's salary is $400. Is it enough? The doctor with a certificate does not find work, as well as the engineer. Are there any projects or hospitals that provide work chances? Let new factories open to help workers find a chance. Is there electricity for factory work? If there were factories and construction projects, no one would need anyone else. We wouldn't need anything from the Israeli occupation, and no one would starve, because when a worker gets a chance, sometimes it's going to be much better than an employee's.
هنا كان في مشروع تطوير البحر وبالتالي توسع.
There was a project to develop the beach, thus expanding the street by the beach, but the work stopped. Look at this sidewalk. They are supposed to be paving another lane of the street. During the time I spent heading to the office or going home, I used to see many machines, engineers, and laborers working on the project. However, they aren't working anymore due to the lack of construction materials and fuel. This caused the company to stop the development of the street. In addition, many of the workers and engineers who used to work on the project stopped and became a part of the unemployed sector that already existed in the Gaza Strip.
The continuous closure of tunnels and the border crossings does not only exacerbate the high rates of unemployment, it also severely affects the performance of factories, the supply, the local market, with many essential products.
After stopping our work and having it ruined, you can see that we are hunting for work in making a wallet or repairing a bag, just like that. During the past 6 months, we noticed a slowdown in the sectors of clothes and sewing. That happened because of the lack of activation. You can add to this the productive and service sectors. They would be severely affected, and we would go back to the time, before 3 or 4 years ago, when there was great unemployment, a lack of goods and materials needed daily, and a growing crisis in many sectors that would unfortunately worsen the humanitarian and social problems in the Gaza Strip. I was affected anyway. I cannot even fulfill the requirements of my customers or serve their interest. I pack gravel, but I can't do the same with cement. However, there is no cement, and when it is available, I can work with other workers. You can see that nobody works. Cars do not work, or employees either. Some workers come here seeking a chance at work, but I tell them there are no construction materials. If you can bring me any materials in the local market, I am ready to give you a chance at work. I've got the money and the intention. I am also in a hurry. I need to move to my new house. Today we ordered the bricks. The factory said that the bricks are not ready because there is no cement. I have been asking a blacksmith to build me a stair rod. The blacksmith agrees to make me one, but says we should agree on something first. He asks for extra money. When I ask about the reason, he says because there is no steel.
Freezing of small or large projects, the obstruction of industrial facilities, and the increase of the unemployment rate to more than 40% are all considered disasters that threaten to affect a wide range of the population of the Gaza Strip.
I and my sister-in-law were in the kitchen. My son was standing here, and my sister-in-law's sons were there. I was preparing milk for my son, and he was catching my clothes crying. The boiling pan slipped from my hand and burnt it. I should have gone to the hospital, but I couldn't afford it. I didn't have $1 to go to the hospital. I had a bacterium in the blood, and the doctor told me that this infection was caused by a polluted environment. I told him about the condition of our house, and during winter, my house becomes full of water. He said that was the reason. I recently had some analysis and found that I have problems in my chest. The doctor said I need medical treatment, and the prescription contained only two pills that cost $30, and I can't afford buying one. How would I buy those pills? The doctor gave it to me for free once because he knows about my situation. He also treats my patient's son and follows his case. He paid for the medication that time, but how would I afford paying for the rest? How can I buy two pills for $30?
The Palestinians are steadfast and patient people. They have been suffering, but they are aware that the main reason is the Zionist occupation. The occupation has been trying to suppress the Palestinians, but we say that they are patient, steadfast, and will continue to be so. They will keep fighting the occupier with their steadfastness and an honorable attitude opposing these conspiracies.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A wastewater network that monitors for COVID-19 trends is warning that cases are once again rising in many parts of the U.S., according to an analysis of Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data, reports Bloomberg News. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by William Rivers Pitt, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. sewer data and surges abroad should remind us the pandemic isn't over. Here's the story. The method of testing wastewater to detect virus levels within a whole population has been around since the days of polio. But it took a March 2020 outbreak of COVID-19 in Austria to turn the technique into a mainstay in the pandemic fight. In the United States, where the last president fled, even the idea of mass COVID testing for fear of harming his re-election campaign, wastewater testing has become one of the best and only ways to track viral trends among broad swathes of the population. That's the good news. The bad news, the numbers are inching up again. A wastewater network that monitors for COVID-19 trends is warning that cases are once again rising in many parts of the U.S., according to an analysis of Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data, reports Bloomberg News, adding, more than a third of the CDC's wastewater sample sites across the U.S. showed rising COVID-19 trends in the period ending March 1st to March 10th, though reported cases have staged near a recent low. This brings to bear a number of disturbing possibilities. Scientists have been watching the BA2 subvariant with growing levels of concern. It is already making a strong showing in parts of Europe. It is entirely possible BA2 is already present in the United States and is at least partially responsible for the rise in cases across the country. If so, the damage done by Delta and Omicron will be instructive in the weeks and months to come. It has been wisely said, however, that one should not think of zebras upon hearing hoofbeats. Occam's razor suggests an exhausted nation is shedding its personal COVID protection on the gossamer promise that a corner has been turned. Mask mandates are all but gone except in a few key and continually contentious arenas, such as school districts and commercial airlines. Thus, the current rise in cases could be due to a segment of the populace letting down its defenses because the TV said, everything's cool now. You will come on out and be capitalist again. The news may tell you, we are returning to normalcy, the scientist said, but 8,000 dead a week tells a different story. If this uptick continues, it runs the risk of taxing Americans' already battered healthcare infrastructure if or when BA2 does come knocking. The new COVID outbreak in some parts of Europe, on the other hand, has the potential to rattle the entire world. Any significant disruption could further undermine the global supply chain and risks exacerbating growing inflationary pressures. Foxconn, whose client list includes Apple, informed CNN upon query that the date of factory resumption is to be advised by the local government. torture.
Domestic violence is abuse that happens in a personal relationship. Domestic violence affects men and women of any ethnic group, race or religion, rich or poor, teen, adult or elderly. But most of its victims are women. In fact, one out of four women will be a victim at some point. The abuser may use fear, bullying, and threats to gain power and control over the other person. These signs of abuse may happen soon after the start of the relationship and might be hard to notice at first. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Affluent, educated, safe, this is Singapore's public face. But this seemingly ideal country, famously known as the Little Red Dot, has her dark secrets. The unemployment rate stands at less than 5%, and the crime rate is one of the lowest in the world. But other numbers tell a different side of her story. 1 in 10 women in Singapore has experienced physical violence or sexual abuse, and 6 in 10 have endured violence repeatedly. But only a fraction of these victims come forward to the authorities for help. This week on Aperture, we will take a walk into the world of abused spouses in Singapore and follow the journey of three abused women to learn of their trauma, hear of their heartbreak, and share their dreams. Stay with us.
When an educated society hears but does not listen,
he would beat me up in front of his mom, in front of my maids, in public.
When victims are shamed into silence.
I didn't want people to know that, you know, I was like one of the statistics, you know, oh, abused wife, and then, you know, the pity, and then, you know, the whispering, the gossiping and all that. I really didn't want any of that.
When home is no longer a safe haven, where do these women find the courage to be no longer victims? Singapore, a small island nation with big dreams. Where 1 in 4 have a university degree. 90% own a home. The unemployment rate stands at an underwhelming 2%. And over 100,000 millionaires call this home. But behind the numbers, there are secrets best kept hidden.
I thought he would be a good husband. During courtship days, he really took very good care of me. He really doted on me, was very affectionate, very loving. I would say that he went out of his way to accommodate my requests, you know. So there was really no warning signs, you know, that he would change so drastically after marriage.
At 20, Rachel found out she was pregnant.
I think it's more of society's pressure than, you know, because 16 years ago, it's not very acceptable, you know, to be a single mother. And also, I wanted a complete family for my kid. So it was more of an obligation.
Just months into the marriage, the verbal abuse started.
From someone who's very loving to you, you know, who treated you like a queen, you know, put you on a pedestal, and then, you know, suddenly that someone actually tells you, you know, that you are the reason why he lost his job, you know, because of certain superstition or, you know, your birthday clash, you know, that kind of thing, and you know, it's all your fault. And then how can you put on so much weight after pregnancy? I didn't sign up for that, you know, and I can't even bear to look at you now.
This was the start of Rachel's 8-year ordeal of living with an abusive husband. She was 5 months pregnant with her first child.
We were having an argument. I was defending my point of view. And then he just snapped and he just shoved me.
Abandoned, shocked, betrayed. Rachel struggled with all these emotions.
I think most importantly is that I really didn't want to accept the fact that, you know, he was like that, and, you know, that's the way it's going to be moving on. And given the fact that, you know, we are already married and we have a child on the way, you know, I felt very trapped.
Money and the lack of close family support also reduced her options.
Emotionally, was because my parents didn't like him. So it was a case of, like, you know, I told you so. Back then, the laws didn't allow divorcees to buy their own house, so housing would be an issue. Also, in terms of financially, I wonder if I would be able to support the child on my own.
Rachel hoped the baby would change him, make him softer, happier. But the stresses of first-time parenthood quickly dispelled her illusions.
Things got actually worse when the baby kept crying. You know, he would scream at me and ask me, you know, oh, what kind of mother are you? Don't even know how to take care of your own kid. I don't see other people's babies screaming or crying like that, you know.
His anger reached a boiling point after he lost his job and the family became reliant on Rachel's income.
He perceived it as some kind of attack on his manlyhood. And given the fact that I gradually earned more than him over the years, it didn't bode well for our relationship.
A few drinks, a perceived disobedience, and the cycle would start again.
He was hitting me, he was raining blows on me, and I fell over the wrong way. Yeah, I actually hit the my back actually hit against the side of the coffee table, yeah, and I just fell over. Yeah, so my back was thrown at a very unnatural angle.
Hours flowed into days, weeks into months, months into years. But all roads still led headfirst into a brick wall.
I really lost count. I've been in A&E for my slip disc. I thrown out my back, various kind of bleeding, head injuries. I had to go for CT scan, MRIs.
All this time, Rachel chose to hide her pain and lead a double life.
Sometimes I feel like such a fraud, you know. Obviously, at home, I'm going through all these things, you know, and I already feel very injured. Injured not only physically, you know, emotionally. Feel very betrayed, you know. Feel very angry. And you have to hide all that, you know, because during work, you know, I had to be very professional, okay? And I don't want to bring my personal life into my professional life, you know, and to maintain that kind of professional respect, you know, the kind of facade that I have to put up.
On average in Singapore, 3,000 spousal abuse cases are reported each year. But family violence specialists believe this represents just the tip of the iceberg.
We also know that less than 10% of women who have experienced abuse come forward to the formal helping agencies, whether it's the police or whether it's the family service center. So what prevents these people from getting help?
One key reason why Rachel stayed with her husband for as long as she did was for her children, who never saw their father beating their mother.
While he wasn't a good husband, he was a good father. So I was very conflicted. While I had to take care of myself, I also have to consider the feelings of my daughter. You know, I didn't want her to have a broken family. I really tried to make things work. There was a lot of self-doubt. Am I too strong? Should I be more docile? Should I be more submissive? Should I be more gentle?
All her doubts were finally erased one night.
I was sleeping, you know, he just pulled me out of bed and, you know, he was hitting me. And my elder daughter actually came out of her room. She was very, very shocked when she saw what was going on. She was very brave. She tried to protect me, so she was trying to pull him off me. At that point, I think he was very infuriated, you know. So he didn't realize it was her, so he just flung her off. She was thrown against the wall. That was really the last straw for me, that she was being physically thrown off like that. It just made me snap in a way that I realized that, you know, it had to stop right there and then.
The very next day, Rachel and her two daughters moved out. Her husband immediately tried to apply for a personal protection order against her, saying that she had injured him during the fight.
The officer who processed the case, when he called me up to investigate the matter, you know, I actually showed him the reports, the medical reports, you know, and the different police reports I made over the years, you know, and I showed it to him. I mean, just look, and what do you think? So that case was actually thrown out.
She filed for divorce the very same week, but it took 2 years before the case was settled. Rachel gave up on alimony in exchange for full custody of their children.
I've always told them that whatever happened between me and their father, it's between the adults. And it's very difficult for me to say this, but I always told them, you know, that they shouldn't hate him. They are entitled to feel anger, of course, and to work on that anger, you know. But I don't want them to hate him.
The International Violence Against Women survey that we completed in 2010 was done because we felt that up to that point, as a country, as a nation, we had no idea as to the prevalence of violence against women nationwide. And we found that 9.2%, or 1 out of 10 women that we surveyed, reported they experienced physical violence and or sexual abuse from their partners.
The survey used a sample size of 2,000 women aged 18 to 60 years old and asked very specific questions. Have you been slapped, punched, and strangled? Has sex been forced upon you against your will? And out of those 1 in 10 women who answered yes, another number came to light.
More than half of them said it has happened more than once. 3 times, 6 times, you know. So we're not talking about people who, on the first instance of violence, you know, begin to go to the police or shout for help and all that.
When is domestic violence a public issue? Who has a right to intervene? Why do victims remain silent?
It's not a slap or two. I was really getting beaten up badly in public, in the house, and I still kept quiet and smiled.
Power, control, dominance. These are the driving forces behind domestic violence. Shame, fear, isolation. These are the shackles holding victims in place. Family, children, a happy ever after. This is what Mira hoped for when she married her first love.
We had really good chemistry. I mean, he spoke very, very well. He made me laugh.
In the first year of marriage, when Mira was 7 months pregnant, the violence kicked in.
He used vulgarities on me, calling me a and I answered him back. And that's when he kicked my head like it was a football and stepped on my head. I screamed for help. I tried to open the door as I got up, screaming for my mother-in-law to help. He pulled my hair back, continued to beat me up even more. And after that, he told me why he beat me up, made it my fault. And I had to go down and apologize to my mother-in-law and say it's my fault.
The day Mira's son was born, she saw a flicker of hope.
The day I gave birth, he was awesome. That's when I felt that amazing man I married. He was there throughout the time I was in labor and all. After that, things changed completely because that night itself, drank, came back, being in the hospital. Basically, I was abused terribly as I was practically bedridden in bed, vulgarities, everything. So it became a weekly affair, you could say, of getting abused physically, emotionally, mentally.
Mira's husband had a temper, and he wasn't shy about showing it wherever and whenever his buttons were pushed.
He would beat me up in front of his mom, in front of my maids, in public. Imagine, he beat me up among the clubs in Serangoon Road, dragged me on the road and all. And when someone tried to come and help me, and he told the guy, "This is my wife, you don't touch her, you don't have any right to touch her." Nobody helped me. Everyone just watched the fun.
When Mira's husband lost his temper, it wasn't just a slap or a shove.
He's a very strong guy. He never beat me like it was a woman giving a slap. He beat me up like a guy. 2 fractures, a bleeding nose, multiple bruises to the head, multiple bruises to the thighs, to the back, an extremely swollen rib for a good 2 weeks. Name it. Been there, done that. And yeah, the last one, permanent scar for life, a slash on the face.
Beyond the physical abuse, what cut us deeply were the relentless emotional attacks that shattered her self-esteem.
Emotionally, what he would do is this. He abused me in front of his mom, his maid, his friends. He called me a prostitute. He says I'm a lousy mother. I'm a lousy wife. I should be grateful that he married me, that, you know, I'm living with his family and all that, and food is there and all. I should feel grateful.
We've come across many cases where you have both emotional violence as well as physical violence. And what is really striking is that when a victim relates what she remembers of the incidents, it's very often it's the emotional violence, it's the words used that, you know, actually has the deepest scars.
Mira believes her family would have intervened strongly had they known what was going on, but she chose to hide the abuse from them.
I didn't want to involve my family because I didn't want my family to look down on him. I wanted my marriage to work. Nobody gets married thinking, okay, fine, I get married today, and when am I going to divorce? Nobody does that. Marriage is sacred. A man and woman gets married, they have children, they go to work, they bring up their kids, and you know, they see their kids through teen years and all that. That's life. And that's what I wanted. Why I stuck through is not just simply because of marriage. I really loved him.
Although her family did not know about the abuse initially, her husband's family did. But they chose to turn a blind eye.
My mother-in-law saw me get abused. She watched me get abused. He's got 3 other siblings. I did seek help, crying to his sisters, younger one and older one. Younger one was very much more empathetic towards me. But they felt that they couldn't do anything about it because he was beyond control. I was always told that it's, you know, it's in my hands to change him.
By the end of their first year of marriage, Mira had obtained a personal protection order, or PPO. If her husband is violent against her, he can be fined up to $2,000, jailed up to 6 months, or both. But the PPO does have its limitations. It's not a restraining order which would prevent the abusive spouse from coming near or having contact with the victim.
The perpetrator could follow the victim to work, could call the victim all the time, send her SMSs, you know, multiple SMSs to harass her, could sort of always be within sight of the victim but not actually physically touch her. So all of these things can be intimidating, very, very annoying, disruptive to the victim's life still. And in other countries, the court has the power to actually restrict and to prohibit the perpetrator from carrying out these acts. I think those kinds, the court should actually have wider powers to make such orders in Singapore as well.
Despite the PPO, the threats continued. 10 months later, Mira moved back to her parents' house for the third time. Her husband turned up at the company where she worked.
He came to my office and he humiliated me. He was drunk in the morning, calling me the CBD ho- in front of everyone, lunchtime.
A few days later, he broke into her mother's apartment at 6 in the morning.
He broke into my home with a knife and a brick. I had my siblings, my brother, my son and all there. He pinned me down as I had my son in my arms. He slashed me behind my ear, on my face. I was screaming. Everyone was awake in my home. It was chaos. My sister-in-law, my sister and all helped me. They took my son away. I ran out of the home. I thought he was going to come after me with a knife, but he didn't. All he did was say that he just wanted to disfigure me and leave.
Mira's husband was arrested and sentenced to more than 6 months in prison. He has just been released.
If he's going to try and come back, I would just do the simple thing. I'll call the police. I mean, I have a PPO. So I will call the police and all, and he knows that if he's going to try and come back, it's going to be even a tougher sentence this time. During my marriage, I was really afraid and I lived in fear. So at this point of time, I'm very confident. I don't need to feel afraid anymore.
Waiting, watching, standing still. More often than not, this is the norm, not the exception.
So I think Singaporeans make very good bystanders. I think that's something that is part of our conditioning. We are a society where we are peace-loving, law-abiding, and we generally let the authority take care of a problem. I think that this is a function of, one, Singapore being a fast-paced urban country where there people may not have as much time for each other. There may not be that much trust between strangers, and there is a certain attitude that we should each mind our own business.
How does the law define spousal violence? What happens to cases which don't meet the legal criteria? How do we help the most vulnerable victims?
Yes, we don't have anything. 身份一个好像空空啊，一个非公民这样。要是你离婚了，你回去哪里快乐？一个和孩子分开，看不到。5.2
million people live in Singapore today. Over 2 million of them are foreigners. Drawn here by dreams of wealth, the promise of work, and the hope of love. In recent years, approximately 40% of marriages in Singapore have been between a citizen and a foreigner.
One in three of the women that are presented with issues of spousal violence are actually foreign wives. And this was actually an increase from the previous years, where it was one in five of every woman that came forward to seek help.
Love, convenience, citizenship. There are many reasons why foreign women marry Singaporean men, but one common theme recurs in these relationships.
So generally what we hear from our foreign wives is that there's a sense of fear that they're often threatened by their husbands. At the end of the day, if they are going to report, for example, about the spousal violence incidents, they're going to be sent back to their home countries. And then they risk not able to see their children or maybe even lose custody of their children because of their citizenship or legal right to be in Singapore.
This has been Vu's story since she came to Singapore.
Iranian year Nowruz is almost here.
Nowruz is almost here. Join IRIB English Radio on Sunday afternoon, March 20th, 2022 at 1500 hours GMT as we chime in the new year at 1533 GMT.
Celebrate Nowruz live on air on Sunday afternoon, 20th of March.
Around the traditional haft cuisine table.